Hi everyone, Jason is here.
And Wendy Ma.
And welcome to the second episode of the Chef Pod,
where we are sowing seeds for the future of food.
Yes, and today we've got two really important guests. We've got Trevor Ritchie and Jenna Reich, fresh back from Lyon, France, where they're competing in
Bocuse d'Or, one of the most prestigious culinary competitions in the world.
So we're really looking forward to having a great discussion with them and finding out how they got there and some of the wonderful things they learned on their journey.
All right. Good afternoon. Welcome, Trevor. Welcome, Jenna. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Thank you.
Doing great, Wendy. Nice to see you.
Thank you for coming. Sorry I interrupted you, but thank you for coming in and doing this with us. This is really exciting, and it's a competition that I think all students at George Brown College Culinary would love to hear more about, so this is really appreciated.
Thanks for having us.
So to begin, can you guys give us a little bit of a background on yourselves? Where did you guys work? What inspired you? How did this bring you to this point here at Bocuse?
For me, I found out about this competition at a young age. I've been working in kitchens my whole life, and it was always something that I wanted to do. And as you mentioned earlier, I hope that we did inspire some George Brown students, because I think it's really important, a competition to represent the country and to get young people involved in what's going on, because it's such a big deal and such a great opportunity.
For sure.
I always dreamed of working with food, but I actually didn't know anything about the competition until I was introduced to Trevor. My chef at the time knew that he was looking for someone to be his commis, and I sort of dove in blind. I was really inspired by his passion and commitment to the competition, and so it was something that I wanted to be a part of once I heard about it from him. And yeah, the rest is history. Suddenly I was full on the Bocuse journey.
So Trevor, you had been working at George Brown College as an instructor and as a professor when you sort of started working towards your journey towards Bocuse. Jenna, you were in school as well at George Brown while this was happening, yeah?
Yes.
Or had you left school? Had you graduated at this point?
I was actually just finishing baking and pastry arts management when we were introduced. So timing actually worked out really well. We met just at the end of my program, and I honestly didn't think much of it just because I didn't know anything about it, and finished school, did some traveling, came back, and he reached out and said, so are you interested in this? I still had no idea. So we met and sat down in the middle of Union Station, and he talked to me about it for like 2 hours straight. And after that, I was hooked. Just I wanted to be a part of this thing that I still didn't know that much about.
That's pretty amazing. So this is a culinary competition. This is not a pastry competition. And you graduated from baking and pastry arts management. So what led you to choose someone who came out of pastry as opposed to culinary, chef?
Well, first thing for me, I wanted to find somebody with a good attitude, strong work ethic, and Jenna was very mature for her age, and I had a good feeling. I definitely went with my gut on that one, and I'm a chef that believes that there's not really a big divide between pastry and savory cooking. I believe that they're actually quite the same, as well as, you know, the other elements that make up, a restaurant in front of house. I just have a way of thinking that it's all, you know, related to giving a guest experience. So whether you're pastry, you're front of house, you're a sommelier, I mean, to me, it's almost all integrated and all the same. But most importantly, I wanted somebody with a good attitude, work ethic. So I was introduced to a lot of students, and, you know, we have, you know, the cream of the crop here in downtown Toronto, George Brown College. So there are a lot of students to choose from, and it wasn't an easy task for me. But you know, I went with my gut, and it worked out perfectly. So
that's awesome. I think that speaks wonders to both programs as well too. That's fantastic. Very, very good.
Mm-hmm. So I guess just from listening to your guys' response there, I'd actually really like to know what you said to her about the Bocuse d'Or competition that sold her on something that she knew nothing about.
Well, truthfully, and it's probably the only negative thing I'll ever say about Jenna, is that I had a feeling that I wanted her to come along with me on this journey and the rest of the team. But I did kind of mention it to her in passing, and I gave her a hint, but she didn't really pick up on it. She's like, yeah, okay, Bocuse, like whatever, you know. And then I had to kind of track her down a little bit. I had to like, Jenna, like, Do you understand what I'm asking you? And then, you know, I understand. And then I sat her down eventually. And then I think she started to understand, holy crap, you know, this is a pretty cool experience.
This is real.
This is, wow, this is actually a lot bigger than, you know, some competition I've never heard of. Like, and then I think she just, she knew right when she found that out, it clicked in her mind, and she just, okay, yes, I'm on board, chef. So
we've got the Bocuse d'Or, created by famous chef Paul Bocuse in Lyon in 1987. It runs every 2 years. It takes 24 chefs from around the world. What's the kind of the lead up to get to Lyon and start competing?
Well, I mean, truthfully, it's been so much longer than the time that I've been at George Brown, which is just about 4.5 years now. But truly, the journey for me started over 10 years ago. But I've been dreaming of competing in this competition, and I did several other competitions, but I always had in my mind that I was going to be competing in Bocuse. And I, you know, it sounds cliche, but you know, you put your mind to something and you work hard and you make it happen, right? I believe you make your own fate. So I've been working on this competition for so long, and it has been a really long journey. But on paper, we had the national selection in 2016 in April. So, you know, over, you know, 2.5 years ago. And so I've competed against other Canadian chefs, and I won the competition nationally. So then what happens is we move on to the continental selection. So all over the world, there are 60 countries that try to get into the final to Bocuse d'Or. So there's continental selections, just as you would have in, like, say, the World Cup of soccer. Mm-hmm. So we had to go up against North, Central, and South America. And the top 5 out of 12 teams earned their spots in the final in Lyon. So that was an opportunity for us to work together as a team, you know, take the flight down to Mexico. It was actually in Mexico City.
And this was in 2018, where you were
doing Mexico? Was in 2018.
Yeah. And you placed silver in Mexico.
We placed silver, yeah. So that was great, and we're really proud of that. And that gave us some great momentum going towards the final.
That's wow, interesting. And so, Jenna, next question is going to sort of be for you. Had you had a mind for competing up until this point, or, you know, chef, Richie, like a competition, chef is very different than a chef in the kitchen or a chef in a cafe or in a hotel. But Jenna, like what sort of led you down this path of wanting to, of getting the competition bug, or was it just Chef Richie's nudging to get you into it?
it was actually a few things. I grew up as a competitive dancer, so I was always competitive. I always liked being in that setting and really pushing myself. But I hadn't previously competed in any culinary competitions. So it was a great way to sort of exercise that part of me again, the part that wanted to compete to win, but this time in this passion that I was sort of pursuing as my career. So it was never my plan to get into cooking competitions by any means, but it was just, for me, it's always been about what's the best learning opportunity, and this presented itself, and it was impossible to say no to. Like, everything was right there telling me, look at all you're going to learn here. It was totally out of my comfort zone. So I chose to go down that path.
Just on that note, what was one of the most, what was something that you learned that you never thought you would learn when you went down this path?
Truthfully, because I was sort of figuring it all out as I went, a lot of it was sort of unexpected, just because I obviously knew where we were headed, what we were aiming for, but I was sort of figuring out what exactly was needed from me as we were going. So anything from hard skills in the kitchen in terms of cooking techniques that I hadn't previously used, just because I only had a pastry background, to just the way I was working. Trevor instilled in me how to work clean and how to use as little as possible. And that's something that we definitely took with us to France. We wanted to have very minimalist kitchen and only the bare minimum, and create what we could with almost nothing, in a way, visually speaking. So I think all around I came out a much more efficient and well-rounded sort of person in the kitchen rather than someone who's just focused on pastry and not really thinking about how many bench scrapers I have or how many times I've wiped down my station in the past 5 minutes.
Wow. So a lot of systems and procedures and mm-hmm. repetition and really honing your skill.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's yeah. fantastic. How many times did you actually make the dish that you presented at the Bocuse d'Or?
That's a really tough question to answer. The full program, meaning the plate and the platter, we have to do these elaborate platters.
Yeah.
And then there are also these plated dishes that are, you know, super, super complex. But I mean, the full run we did over 15 times, which doesn't actually sound like a lot, but just to give you a perspective, to prepare just to do the practice takes an entire day at least. It actually takes longer to get prepared for the practice than to do the actual practice, because everything is so perfectly measured and, you know, put in the perfect place. And this is like so much more than just the cooking. It's the organization, and it's more of a like highly choreographed dance, you know.
Yeah, you got what
exactly.
Yeah, it set me up for it perfectly.
Yeah. I mean, nothing's by chance, right? Yeah. It's like, okay, she's a dancer. Okay, that's she has a competitive spirit. She can stand on stage. I mean, that's one thing you can't prepare yourself for. You're in a. Imagine you have to cook the best dish of your life. That's hard enough as it is, right? Now you're going to a foreign country in front of, you know, hundreds of 3 Michelin star superstar chefs right in your face watching you, and you have thousands of screaming people in the stadium, and you're in an unfamiliar kitchen. So,
and this is being live broadcasted.
Yeah,
no,
like
stress level is very high
and the standards are high. I mean,
yeah.
Everybody knows that this is like the world's most prestigious culinary competition, so you have to have nerves of steel. And Jenna, you know, I thought, okay, I could picture her, you know, as a young person, maybe on stage and having that same feeling. So, you know, calculated decision on our part.
That's absolutely unbelievable. That's so, so cool that you're able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Well, I mean, based on that, were you given a theme going into the competition, knowing how you guys practiced it?
Were we given a theme?
To like your presentation dishes and
okay.
platters.
So we are assigned the proteins that we have to do. And then we build all of our dishes around that, promoting Canadian cuisine and culture and just ingredients that are sort of representative of what we do here. So we had to prepare a rack of veal that had to be roasted on the bone. They're very specific about that.
They wanted no sous vide, from what I understand.
Right.
It had to be, classic cooking techniques.
Yes.
And when were you told about the rack of veal? Was that your main protein? That was the main showcase piece?
Yeah, that was mid-September.
So you had about 5 months to prepare for.
Yeah. And before that, we were working on sort of generic flavored garnishes that we were hoping we could sort of integrate into
perfect.
Whatever protein we were assigned. And then at the end of October, we were assigned what the fish dish would be, which was another unconventional challenge. It was a shellfish and vegetable chartreuse, which is not commonly known here or in most places in the world. It's essentially a vegetable and shellfish savory cake, if you will. So
wow.
That was a great test for you, I think.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was a challenge that a lot of chefs faced around the world. And they were even putting on their social media posts like, I'm not embarrassed to say I don't know what a chartreuse is,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And I had to look it up. And so my first thing was, it's a very French dish. So I went to some of the more experienced French chefs at the school and said, hey, what's chartreuse? Do you know what chartreuse is? And they're like, really? They're making you do chartreuse? Oh, man. You have a big challenge ahead of you. So,
did you have a lot of support from the Toronto French culinary scene? In your dishes, were you leaning on anyone, any French chefs in the city or in Canada for inspiration or help?
Yeah, well, we were fortunate enough to work with JP Chalet, who's a good friend of George Brown College, and you know, does lots of things in the industry and in the community. And he was a great support, a great asset for us. We weren't necessarily looking for French chefs, but we were looking for talented chefs. Maybe they come in and taste something or offer an opinion. One of the big challenges that we had was we don't really have a Boku store culture in Toronto.
Yeah.
The first chef actually to represent Canada in 1987 was Jamie Kennedy.
Jamie Kennedy.
But besides that, we have Brian Morin, who competed quite a long time ago, who was actually a professor at George Brown.
He was in 93, right? Morin?
That sounds about right. Yeah. But, you know, we don't have a lot of Boku chefs that we could work with here, right? A lot of the experienced Boku chefs were from Vancouver.
Yeah.
So that was a big challenge that we had.
Is that a Canadian thing, do you think? Like, or do we not just have a really big competitive culture compared to like France and Denmark and Sweden and Spain? Or
I think we do. We are definitely revered as a culinary competition country. We have a lot of success in the past in the Culinary Olympics, and we have a great reputation at the Boku store. The challenge that we're facing is partly due to our geography. I mean, if I want to pick up the phone and call somebody from Vancouver to talk about what their experiences are, I mean, that's one thing, but can you just get in your car and drive to George Brown? You know, can you just like, you know, hop on the train? And can you work with us for the weekend? You know, that wasn't really an option. So we had to, if we wanted to do that, we would have to fly them in. You know, you obviously have to take care of them. You have to put them up in a hotel or a B&B. And you know, funding is another challenge that we have, right? So we don't necessarily have the finance, you know, in order to do those things.
Could you give us kind of an overview of what it costs to go down this journey?
It's a hugely widespread difference between what countries have. So some countries will go in, let's say, $40,000 for the entire process, and you can imagine that would be gone just on flights and where are you going to stay when you're in France. And so that's bare minimum, right? And then you have, and those countries are competing up against other countries that have multi-million dollar budgets with government funding,
right?
And it's a complete, you know, David versus Goliath sort of situation, right? Canada, we are getting better. We're definitely on the incline. I think we made some great progress and created a lot of excitement towards the competition. So we're hoping all of the things that we work towards continue to grow, and that we, you know, leave a stronger legacy for Boku Store Canada.
That's pretty amazing. Wow. So you're on your way to the Bocuse now. You know you've got to make a shellfish chartreuse. You have to make roast a veal. Was it veal rack or veal breast?
Rack of veal.
Rack of veal. And what's the parameters in the competition? What can you bring in? What do they have? What's sort of the outline of the competition?
So it's a 5 hour and 35 minute time period.
5 hours, 35 minutes.
Yes. And we're allowed to bring in peeled vegetables, nothing shaped, and we can bring in pre-measured ingredients, but nothing prepared, nothing mixed. They do a full sort of check of all of your ingredients. Sauces, you're not allowed to bring in anything prepared,
okay. Really.
So
you're making your jus a la minute and within the 5 hours. Are you allowed stocks?
You're allowed stocks.
Okay.
But yeah, it's pretty much you're going from scratch
once you
get into that kitchen. So that's why it has to be so choreographed, why you have to know exactly what you're doing, because of the detail of everything. You have to use every second.
Right.
It's very, very intense.
Pre-measured ingredients, they were provided for you there in Lyon, or you had to bring some from here in Canada?
We did bring some things from Canada. We bought most of our produce over there. It was just the sponsored products, so the shellfish and the veal that we were given when we were there at the competition. Everything else we were responsible for getting ourselves, preparing ourselves ahead of time.
Were you given a budget at all, or did you just go out and just buy what you want to use?
Yeah, the best product that we could possibly find, like whether that was Canadian or French, or you know, the taste is such a big part of the Boku store, and they're all world renowned chefs that are tasting the food. So at the end of the day, you know, it has to taste amazing.
Yeah,
truthfully, we were sort of finessing our flavors right up until the last day because we were working with some produce that we were getting for the first time in France. So for the most part, that just made everything better. But we needed to test everything. We needed to make sure that flavor was our first and foremost priority. in the food that we were serving. So it was all about that and, you know, tailoring everything to the palate rather than just the eye.
Wow. So you're in a kitchen, a set kitchen. How many people are competing at the same time at this point?
It's 12 countries per day.
Okay.
So there are 12 kitchens set up, and it's every 10 minutes that a country starts cooking. Okay. So it's staggered.
Oh, they stagger them 10 minutes apart? So what time did you start actually cooking? What time did you get in there?
I think it was 9:20 or something like that. Yeah. We get an hour to set up the kitchen, and then it's just go.
Yeah. So we were the ninth kitchen on the line. So that meant that by the time our chartreuse came out and our platter came out, they'd already seen 9 other chartreuse.
No way.
And then 9 other platters. And it actually got pretty chaotic from the looks of it. I looked back at some of the footage and there was just so much going on at once because they were presenting platters and whole chartreuse and then cut
right
chartreuse.
But you're not doing the cutting, though,
no,
right?
No,
like, so there's volunteers who are doing the serving after you presented the platter? Or?
Well, normally it's a fish dish and there's no carving involved.
Right.
But this shellfish cake, you had to cut it. So that was actually the coach's responsibility. So that's something new that they integrated.
Okay.
They always try to put something new and a new twist to keep you on your toes.
Right.
It used to be that countries would start training 2 years in advance. They would say, okay, you know, next 2021, you're going to be cooking halibut.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're a country that has a lot of financial backing, you know, your chef takes or, you know, leaves their job, they're full-time working on Bocuse, and they've been cooking halibut for 2 years. So they want to make it a little bit more natural. So they put these twists in. So this year, that was the twist. But we do have to leave our kitchen to plate our veal, a rack of veal. So I had to go out and cut it off the bone, portion it, and Jenna helped to execute the plating of the garnishes. And
how many portions are you plating when you're
it's 14 plates and then 14 portions on the
so
platter.
You do leave the kitchen to go do the plating. I was going to say how hectic that would have been with all the judges and 11 other kitchens, I guess, right beside you. So did you notice others while they were going up, or were you just in the zone that...
I don't think I put my head up once. You know, we never do. There's really no time for it. And we had obstacles in the kitchen. I'm sure everybody had something, you know, that they could, they say they had an obstacle with.
Yeah.
We lost power, for example. Like, that's a big one.
What?
How long?
Well, I lost power completely on my section. So there's my section and Jenna's section. We had no power on my section. So we had somebody during our 5 hours come in and try and fix it. Didn't fix it. Came in again. And then I had to turn them away because, you know, I don't have time for them to be in there. It was just the right decision. So I had to do all of my blending and food processing, whatever I needed, electrical, I had to go over to Jenna's.
You had to improvise your dance, jump over to Jenna's side.
Yeah,
so that was
much like a chef would do, freestyle it, like you got it, like service is on, you got
to
do it.
Yeah, but no matter what, you know, you always find a way to get it done.
That's
and
amazing.
So thankfully, we were able to keep the ship afloat. I mean, the products, that was another challenge. We had been working with a different veal. The one that showed up on my table at the competition was way different than what I had been practicing with.
Oh, no.
And there's no way around that, right? I mean, we can't get French veal here. We did once. I'm not going to tell you how we got it, but we did once. We got a few of the supposedly sponsored ones, but even those were far different than the ones that we actually got. So,
what an elaborate production. So, I mean, yes, there's you two. You guys worked hand in hand this whole journey. Was there another team supporting you? When we talk about support, who was behind the team, Richie and Reich?
we had a lot of people sort of coming in and offering their support. Our main guys, I guess, were Kevin Buck and Nick Lynn. We couldn't have done any of it without them.
Both Nick Lynn is a JVC graduate.
Yeah,
from
so
is, school.
And Kevin.
And Kevin Buck
well.
Had just graduated
yeah.
as well.
From the Italian program.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they were along for the ride with us pretty much the whole time, I guess. Both of them helped out, at least in some part, with the last team. So I was sort of the newest one. So we needed that extra knowledge and experience along the way. Yeah, and then, of course, we had our coach, James Olberg, and, so many
other sponsors. You had some sponsors helping you along the way.
Yeah, we had some sponsors that had helped out the previous year. Rouget, Coco Berry, True North Seafood, a bunch of, you know, a few smaller companies as well. Mm-hmm. But I mean, truthfully, we started the new organization just over a year and a half ago. As it moved to Toronto, we didn't have a lot of the same infrastructure that existed in the West Coast, for the reasons kind of that I mentioned earlier. But we started a new organization, and Boku Store Canada is looking to become a complete independent organization in the very near future. So we almost started with nothing, like no money in the bank over a year ago. And there's still so much to work to do, but we made some great headway for sure.
So you mentioned you've been planning this for 10 years, knowing that this was one of your goals. And then you just mentioned your other two assistants had helped in the previous competition as well. But moving into, I recently heard that the new 2019 at the Restaurant Canada show, they announced the new competitor for 2021, is it? Chef Samuel Sirois. Would you be part of his coaching or his journey? And now you're saying that Boku Store Canada is going to be a new entity. Is it all moving over to Montreal? Is that where he's from?
Yes, he's from Montreal. He teaches at the ETHQ, which is the big culinary school, the George Brown, if you will, of Montreal. But yeah, great school. He's going to have good support there, I'm sure. He's a very passionate chef. And our manager that helped us on our road to Lyon is actually from Montreal as well. So that works out very well. And I'm hoping to be involved in the team, and I will be in some way. We haven't quite worked out exactly how that's going to happen. But, you know, I mean, a train ride there is not too bad
compared to Vancouver.
So, you know, it was really important for me at the end of Bocus, and I told myself and the rest of the team 2 years ago, you know, if you guys want to be a part of the team, I expect you in some way to help out the next team, whether that's just a phone call or, you know, if there's an event happening in Toronto, we want you guys involved, because it was really important for me, because all of the obstacles that we had to face, not knowing what to expect there, or not having Bocuse, a chef that I could go to that's local, that say like, hey, you know, what kind of equipment do you bring? How did you get equipment? What type of product should I be looking at? What are the judges looking for taste? I mean, there's a million questions that I would love to ask somebody. And
were you able to get those answered yourself from your coach, James Olberg?
As best as I could, yeah. We're fortunate enough that James got to go the year before. But he had some of the similar struggles that we did. And thankfully, we grew a little bit from that experience. But we're hoping to grow even farther now. I always wanted to make sure that when I'm done, you know, all of my... knowledge and understanding of the competition that I've learned, that I can help the next candidate, whoever it is, because, you know, very proud Canadian chef. And I really just want to see Canada do well at the end of the day. And it's important to me.
That's awesome. Where did you do all the practicing? Like, it sounds like you put thousands and thousands of hours into practicing and preparing for this. Where did you do most of that?
Mostly George Brown. Yeah, we have our setup kitchen at George Brown. So we were here most of the time. We did a little bit of traveling around the country because, again, I thought it was important to have like a national organization. Mm-hmm. So we made a strong effort to make it out to Vancouver. We did a fundraiser there, Montreal. We didn't make it to the East Coast, but we tried to get across the country as best we could. Regina was amazing. The chefs there were like super supportive, and, you know, small town, but they were like all on board and so passionate. They threw like two fundraisers for us. The Chef Association in Regina, you know, hats off to them and shout out to them for sure. But, you know, it was great to have chefs, I think, right now getting really excited about the competition. It used to be that a lot of people didn't know what it was. And thanks to, you know, chefs like in the States, particularly like Thomas Keller, Daniel Ballou, are heavily invested in that team. I think their presence in the Boku Store community has really raised awareness and raised the bar. And everybody, all the countries know, you know, I have to step up now. They all have to step up because you have these big name chefs and everybody wants to be a part of it now. And it's a pretty exciting thing.
Awesome. So it's 9:20 in the morning, Lyon, France. You just started. What's going through your mind?
It's another practice. Do it. Make the best food of your life. I mean, every time we made the food, we wanted it to be even better than the last time. And that's why we were constantly tweaking it. So it was just a matter of doing that again, you know, not letting yourself be affected by those brand new factors around you. It's just head down and get the job done. Like that was sort of the least stressful part for me. Like that was what we'd been training for. That was what we practiced. It was just another day in the kitchen. So I was there to do a job, and that's all I was focused on doing.
So what time was your fish dish supposed to go?
Well, it would have been, if it was 9:20, in fact, then it would have been 2:20.
Okay.
And then it would have been 35 minutes after that. So 2:55.
Yep.
So 2:55, the fish has to go up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then your veal is coming up. It's coming up shortly thereafter.
Just over half an hour.
Just a half an hour later, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And okay. You play both of those at the same time, though? You go to the judge with both courses?
No, you do the... So there's actually 12 countries on each day, but all 24 judges. So one judge from each country.
Okay.
And they draw. They either draw 50-50. Either they're judging the plate or the platter. Okay. So those judges show up for both days. And you have 12 judges that are judging the plate and 12 that are judging the platter.
Okay.
So the first, the plate goes to the plate judges. And then 35 minutes later, the meat goes to the meat judges.
Okay.
So they're only judging 50% of what you're doing.
I see. Yeah. And you're not in front of them while they're judging. Obviously, you're continuing on with the veal dish after.
They're facing the craziness of the crowd. Yeah. And it's loud in there. You know, like we wouldn't be able to hear each other talk right now. You have the UK BAM with a full-on, what do they call it, a brass band?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Full-on brass band. You have the Danish team with these massive drums. The Swiss came with these massive
horns,
like the size of a backpack, these cowbells.
It
was so loud. So ours was really cool, actually. Jenna's parents came up with this idea. Jenna's dad, I think. But he was clever. He got some maple syrup cans and put a hole in them. And then he threw all these marbles in there. And those things were pretty obnoxious.
So then actually you guys also trained to not speak to each other. Then if you can't even hear each other, did you guys converse in those 5.5 hours?
Very little, no more than usual. Like we didn't really need to.
I guess I need to use your power now.
What did Trevor say when the power went down? Do you remember what he said to you?
He said, oh, this is new. but no, for the most part, like, we didn't need to converse. That was part of the choreography, you know. A lot of people actually noticed our chemistry in, like, over the time that we worked together, how we were able to sort of dance around each other, and it gave us a nice flow in the kitchen, so it made it easy to work together. So that was a bonus, because we wouldn't be able to hear each other anyway.
We were going to ask you what ingredient scares you, but it sounds like the chartreuse scared both of you.
I think the chartreuse scared everybody. Yeah, we had a ton of chefs coming up to be like, oh man, that chartreuse, like, you know.
Yeah.
And then I remember the U.S. competitor came up to me. He's like, I think it's going to be the chartreuse that decides this one, you know, like. So that was a big challenge for everyone because it was unfamiliar. And you're trying to figure it out, but then you're also trying to outthink the other countries. So that was a massive challenge. And in being so late, like they announced the veal in September. They didn't announce the chartreuse, I think, till late October. So the clock is definitely ticking. If you're thinking about packing up all your stuff, getting over there, all the training, because then you find out it's chartreuse. Now, how do I integrate this thing that I don't know what it is, I haven't figured it out, into my program that we've already set, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not even set either. I mean, I talked about these platters, but these platters are like these outrageous, artistically crafted masterpieces without any food on it. Right. And we were fortunate enough, at George Brown, we have the design school. So that was great for us. I mean, it was logical.
Platter for you, yeah?
So yeah, the design school at GBC, actually designed our platter for us, as well as our menus. They did our photography.
Wow.
There's so much to this than just cooking. So we were lucky enough to have them on board, and you know, they did a fantastic job for us. And so you're trying to figure out, you know, how does the food taste and all that. And then we have to put it on this crazy platter that, you know, we didn't get to put the food on the platter until we were in Lyon. And I think a lot of...
Had you practiced in Lyon? Were you practicing when you're in Lyon?
We practiced a little, not a full-timed practice, but we put the food on there. And we've been working on this veal for like 4 months and we're like, okay, yeah, you know, eventually we were like, okay, we're good.
Is it because you didn't get the platter on time or why had you...
I think a lot of countries go through the same thing because you have so much time to figure out, you know, how to create your dish. Then when you create your dish, then you're okay, I need this stand. I need, you know, a special heating element here. I need this. So that takes time to fabricate, design and fabricate. So I think a lot of countries have the challenge of pushing it right till the end for the platter. So I don't think it was much different than a lot of countries. I think, you know, with experience, we would, if we did it again, we would have our platter earlier. And that's, you know, that's certainly not anyone's fault. It's just something that with the experience, we now know that we need to get that stuff done as best we can a little bit earlier. But in the same sense, we don't want to settle for something that's plain.
Yeah.
So we want to bring the wow, you know, but if you want the wow, you got to take the risk that you're not going to be able to plate the food until later on. And as soon as we're in Lyon and we put the food on the platter for the first time and right away, it's like, we got problems.
Oh, no.
So... I mean,
what was the problem?
Yeah.
We had two garnishes that were same color. It was white and green.
Right.
And it was just something we looked on the plate and it didn't matter to us because you see all the colors. But then you put those two garnishes all in a row and it's like, okay, nope. Like, you know, they're both green and white. That's just got to change. So, I mean, luckily enough, it was an easy fix for us. But it's something that if we would have been able to figure out earlier, it would have given us a little bit more comfort. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, we pulled it off and we did everything we could with what we had. And that goes across the board from...
Are you getting points for like platter design?
Yeah,
big
time.
One of the categories? Yeah.
Big time. Yeah. So it has to look incredible. You have to look at it and just be like instantly wild. Like a car show. You go to a car show and you see that new Ferrari and you go, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that's beside the, you know, getting in the car and driving it and understanding how cool it is and all the features and all that stuff.
But it has to be
that immediate, like, whoa.
Wasn't that like 6 years ago that Spain created like the $1 million egg or something? For the,
yeah, it was this water. Like 3D Death Star looking crazy thing. I don't know what material. It was gold and glass crystal, something.
Wow.
But I mean... I don't want to say I liked it or I didn't like it. It wasn't very Bocuse looking. Mm-hmm. I think...
More avant-garde.
Yeah, but I think the problem with that platter, the challenge with that platter is that it kind of hid the food. Like, imagine a sphere. It was like a sphere sort of
like
thing.
Like an obelisk kind
and
of thing?
Right? Yeah, you had to, like, put the garnishes, like, in it. But if you're putting the garnishes kind of in it, you don't really show them off.
Right.
And it's really about highlighting the food. Like, the food's the most important thing. So
I loved your platter. I thought it was so minimalist. Now, there's a story behind it, from what I understand. Like, it's a watermark of a farm and a piece of grass kind of on the snow. What was the story behind that?
You know what? Like, I was completely obsessed with Bocuse d'Or for a long time, and I still sort of am. And, and yeah, you know, I am a complete, I'll admit, like complete, like an utter hopeless romantic when it comes to Bocuse. So it really was a huge part of my life, and I'm not normally like that with things, but this is like what's so important to me. So everything you put everything into this platter. So for me to even sell myself on this, you know, vision of doing well in Lyon, like I wanted to bring something that represented me. I remember growing up on my aunt's farm. Some of my strongest food memories were growing up, you know, going there in the winter, doing things outside. And in the summer, like to this day, I eat a green bean or a cherry tomato. And I'm like, immediately I go back to my aunt's farm. So that platter to me was like the winter farm. And we had this incredible like texture of snow on the platter. It was pure white. And it actually had like snow hills in it. And different imagery there. We had, these beautiful twills that Jenna made that looked like snowshoes, savory shoe pastry twills. I mean, we had, the one garnish looked like a pine cone, and then back where the veal sat was this golden barn, if you will. It actually had like a look of a barn, and the veal, you know, the veal being in the barn during the winter, like that sort of thing. So there's all sorts of like imagery and thought that goes into that.
Were there students that designed the platter in collaboration with you? Was it design department?
It was a gentleman named Sean Zarabi, who does work for George Brown. I'm not sure for the platter specifically, he got any students involved with that. But I think with regards to the menu and the filming, they're actually making a documentary.
Oh, wow.
So we did tons of filming and they're editing the documentary. You should see the first cut soon.
Oh, good.
It should be really exciting.
That'll be great for Bocuse Canada to try and garner more involvement.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of the top countries have created documentaries in the past, and that helps everyone out, you know, raise recognition for the competition. But yeah, I mean, there's been students involved with this competition in a lot of ways. Training, when we do a full practice, you know, I'll go and ask some students if they want to be involved. And we always had a open door policy. If any chef at the school wanted to, you know, come in and get involved, or a student wanted to get involved, you know, we never turn anyone away. Because I think it's partly for the school, you know, we're representing the country. So, you know, we're not going to be, you know, pushing people away. You know, we want, it's not just for us, right? It's not Trevor Ritchie representing Canada Bocuse d'Or. It's Team Canada representing Team Canada.
Yeah.
Right. So it's so much more than, you know, just the two of us. And
did you get to meet any of your heroes while you were over there?
I know my heroes very well.
Oh, okay. What a great answer.
That is.
Yeah. Jenna, for you?
For me, I think, I don't think I could pinpoint like one specific person. It was so incredible to be in that environment surrounded by so many already highly accomplished chefs and everyone being there celebrating this very high level of cooking. Like, that was just unbelievable to me. So I think just the competition in itself and the organization in itself, that was enough of a wow. It wasn't that I needed to meet one specific chef who influenced me. It was to be surrounded by that much power and passion that was inspiring as it was.
Wow, that's amazing. What's your favorite kitchen tool?
Now, probably a scalpel.
You gotta explain that.
Yeah, I want to know more. So, I'm moving away slowly.
Yeah. Keep your distance.
I mean, everything is so finessed and small in Bocuse. So we would constantly put things on the plate and be like the size of a raisin, maybe next to a garnish, and say, oh, that's huge. Like, it's massive. And it became a running joke, but we were serious. Like, everything had to be so small. So the garnish that I came to work on the most, I think that was our only like, constant one that we sort of developed in maybe July and then kept with it and changed flavors and everything. But it was sort of shaped like a pine cone, and it was a layer of braised artichoke with oxtail gelée, a veal liver mousse, and then snap peas that had been blanched, emptied out, and then filled with a setsu bis. And then I would slice each one with a scalpel and layer it on.
Wow.
So it's insane. Like, straight up, nobody prepares vegetables like that. But I went through phases of it being the most daunting thing to have to do 14 of these alongside everything else in the 5.5 hours to just absolutely obsessing over it and loving it and then hating it again and then loving it again. Wow. So it was such a part of my life for the past few months. I would close my eyes and just see myself assembling pea garnishes. So
the scalpel followed you through that journey.
It did. I don't know how many other places I could use it in the kitchen, but the scalpel will hold a special place in my heart. We'll see what else I can do with it in my future kitchen endeavors.
What's yours, Trevor? Your favorite kitchen tool?
I have to say a spoon. You know, you got to taste, and I love to eat. So.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I used to have nightmares. Like, I'd wake up listening to chip machines. You know, just ripping back when you're talking about cutting those peas. Like, I'd wake up like from a deep sleep and be like, wake up! Like, there's more chips coming in. Right on. What surprised you the most? Like, I know you'd mentioned you lost your power, but which is a massive surprise, and it seems like you worked through that. But was there anything that really kind of stunned you or surprised you when, once you got there?
It's a good question. I mean, it was pretty predictable in most ways. Mm-hmm. What stunned me, I guess, the realization that it was over, you know, like I had been working on it for so long and then all of a sudden it's like,
it's just done.
Oh crap. What do I do now? So, I'm, you know, I had a lot of time to reflect on it. But yeah, no, it sounds funny, but like after Bocuse was the craziest part for me.
What happened afterwards? Like, well, like, so the competition ends, how much time did you have left? Or were you like right on the nose when your dishes went up? What was the story there?
Like, were we on time? Do you mean? Yeah. Yeah. We made time. I think there was one or two countries that were late and they got penalized. But I think generally everybody was on time because you practice so many times and you have your coach standing there, telling you got to go or you're good.
So what were the moments right when time went and you put all the plates up? What were you guys' emotions?
There was no relief at that point because then we had to go to the carving table and then plate everything. And then there was no relief then either because then you had to go back to your kitchen and pack everything up and get out in 45 minutes.
45 minutes.
Yeah. And then there was still no relief because we still had to load everything back into the truck. After that, I think I was able to breathe. It was just, you're always looking for the next thing. And you're right. After it was over, it was like, okay, what's next? Oh, there's nothing left. Like we did all the things, like it's done now. So yeah, it was sort of shocking in a way, especially because we'd had all this adrenaline going through us people would ask me if I was nervous like a week before and I'd say I've been nervous, not too much nervous, just, you know, amped up for the past few months. So coming down from that was like, I think my body itself was stunned. Like I didn't quite know what to do. So I drank wine and slept for 14 hours.
Reorganize your pantry 7 times?
Yes, I did, absolutely.
What was it like the night before the book was for? Did you sleep? Were you able to get a good night's sleep? Was your mind racing? What did you do to sort of to prepare?
I slept very well that night, actually. I think like I said, it was like another practice. Right. And you know, that was the part that I was so looking forward to, was just getting to cook in front of all of these people like we'd been planning to do for so long. So it was just, okay, get a good night's sleep so that you can go and like be your best self tomorrow.
Very nice. What's your favorite comfort food, Trevor?
Schnitzel. Yeah, I come up from I came from Kitchener-Waterloo, and my mother's side's German, and my Oma was a really fantastic cook. So, you know, I remember that like every once in a while on a Sunday dinner. So that's it for me for sure. Yeah.
Nice. Jenna.
Probably macaroni and cheese.
Very nice.
Yeah.
So you guys are done. It's been a couple of weeks. You guys have been able to process it. What's next?
Well, you know, I'm excited to be back at the school, working with the students again, which is, you know, my other great passion. You know, I love working with students, and that was probably the best part and the most fulfilling part of the whole journey that I never really anticipated. But, you know, just working with the students, the grads, the people from George Brown, all my team, Jenna, Kevin, and Nick, and you know, just like Jenna, I pulled out of a pastry classroom that, you know, never worked in a savory kitchen before. And just to the level that she's come, and the other, she's actually going to work at a 3 Michelin star in Norway.
No way.
Nice. Congrats.
This summer, Oslo.
Yeah.
And Kevin Buck, he's now working at a 3 Michelin star in Sweden. He leaves next week. We're having his going away party tomorrow. Nice. And Nick is a superstar too. He was invited to the Asia Pacific Bocuse d'Or to be part of the committee. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's crazy. You know, 3-4 years ago, they're just students in a classroom. And now like to have that impact on the students is far better than any sort of, you know, self self-made like gratification, you know, watching them grow and working with the students. And that's the best part of it, for sure.
That's so inspiring. Mm-hmm. What words of advice would each of you give a young student or a student in general who's listening to this podcast who wants to get involved in culinary? What would be the best place to start? Or what advice would you give to them?
Yeah, just to be humble and get involved into as much as you can. A lot of great schools around the country, but I mean, specifically at George Brown, you have chefs coming in from all over the world. You know, you have so many opportunities, just get involved. And don't forget the personal skills too. You know, it's not just about putting your head down. I mean, that's why I picked Jenna in the first place, is because of her attitude and her work ethic. You know, if you have those things, you guys all watched Ratatouille,
yeah.
You know, anybody can cook. That's a real thing, right? And I had no doubt in my mind that she could, that she would perform amazing because she had the right attitude and the good work ethic. And that's by far to me the most important thing. And read, you know, research. You know, if you're really committed to it, you know, if you're going to do it, then go all in and do it.
That's some really inspiring advice. It's mm-hmm. fantastic. Jenna, what would you say?
Mine would probably just be always be ready to learn, even when you're not expecting to. For me, it's always been about opening myself to opportunity and also get comfortable with failing. Most of what we do, 90% of what we do would fail the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd either build on it or try another idea. And that's something that really, it scared me at first. I didn't like the idea of not getting it right on the first
mm-hmm.
try. But the truth is, if you get it right on the first try, then it probably wasn't challenging enough to begin with. So get comfortable with not succeeding the first time and apply that perseverance to get where you want to be. Because there's always more space to aim higher. And when it's really daunting, I think that's when there's the most potential for that satisfaction, gratification, and then you get to do it all again.
Right.
So don't be afraid, really.
Wow, really inspiring words of advice.
Well put.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Wendy, did you have any other questions that you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I guess just one more. I mean, just based on the storyline, Jenna sort of danced her way into competition. But Trevor, you had said that you had a long history in it. How would you tell an inspired young or just culinary students to get themselves into the competition door?
Yeah, it does come up often. Students ask me, how do you get involved in competitions? And if you want it bad enough, you will find it, right? You don't look for somebody else to find it for you. Talk to the chef, say, what's going on? Is there a competition coming up? I want to do that. And don't be afraid to fail. Like Jenna said, we failed all the time, constantly. Even we went through 20 different garnishes and maybe picked like two of them, you know, and just whatever you have to do, Google, talk to the chefs around, research culinary competitions in Canada and just read like it, you know, you have to do your due diligence and look into that and research the stuff. And depending on how bad you want it, you'll set the bar high. If I'm a kid, you know, in elementary school, I'm getting into high school and I have this dream of playing hockey and I'm really serious. Well, my goal is to I want to be in the NHL, right? I'm not thinking, okay, my life's goal is to play high school hockey. Like if you're really passionate and that's your thing, like you might as well set the bar high. You know, I'm going to compete in the NHL one day. You know, so if you're thinking you were really serious about cooking competitions, why not tell yourself, hey, I'm going to be competing in the Boku store one day. You know, and if you don't get there, at least you're setting the bar high, right? And you won't be considered a failure if you don't get there. You'd only be considered a failure if you fall and then you don't get back up again, right? My vision in the last 10 years was always, I'm going to be the first Canadian chef to make it to the podium, right? I didn't make it to the podium. Okay. But I'm not beaten up about it because I know I did everything possible that I could to get there. And I have no regrets whatsoever. I set the bar high. I was going to be the first Canadian to make the podium. Right. But you know, I came out of it, you know, I fell because I didn't make the podium, but I got back right up again and I knew that I did everything I could to get there. And, so did my team. So I'm super proud, you know.
Awesome.
That's wonderful. Great, inspiring words of advice. We want to thank you both for coming in and taking the time today to discuss your successes with the students and share your journey with us. Thanks so much. So much appreciated.
My pleasure.
Great
thank
talking
you.
To you guys.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you so much.